Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 9th, 2000. In the corner near Fireside Room this morning is Jim Smith. Today's session number is 2002 and it's titled The Cascades, Geography, Geology, Recreation, Celebrating the Land of the Human Spirit, The Coincidence of Holden, Mining and Matrimony. Let's listen in.
I'm going to try to prove that today, that I'm not a geologist. I want to look at the Holden area and the Cascades in general and our lives in general today and get us to think a little differently about our lives in the mountains, perhaps. I kind of call this session The Coincidence of Holden. Now, I guess to start off, I want to talk about a movie. My wife is a French teacher, and we watch a lot of French films because she wants to practice the language. So I've become an expert at reading subtitles. I go quite fast. So to get even one day, I brought home a German film called Run Lola Run, and I didn't know anything about this film. Have you seen the film? Yeah, it's a wonderful film. I'm not going to try to give anything away here, but it's a good German film to see if you don't want to worry about subtitles, because it's mostly watching action take place during the film. And Lola kind of lives on the edge in society. She's a young woman living with a man who also lives on the edge, and they make some sort of savory deal, and you don't know what the deal is, but he's holding a lot of money for some kind of big and nasty looking guy. And he's got to deliver this money to this guy or there's going to be unspeakable evil that happens to him. And he loses the money. And it was in marks, and I don't remember what the exchange rate was, so I don't know how much it was. It was a lot of money. So he calls Lola and says, Lola, I need to get this kind of money. And Lola's dad happens to be a banker, so he's hoping Lola can come to her rescue. So Lola starts running because she knows in 20 minutes her boyfriend's probably going to get dead. And I don't want to say what happens, but in about 20 minutes, all the action had kind of happened, and I thought the movie was over. And it was not real happy. And then suddenly the movie starts up again, right at the beginning, with the same thing. And they run through the same 20 minutes, but they alter the circumstances ever so slightly in the movie. And there's a whole different outcome at the end. And then they do this a third time. So within the course of 108 or 102-minute movie or whatever it was, which I was expecting, I basically saw three different movies with three different outcomes. And the circumstances they changed were tiny circumstances, but the results were huge. And with that as context, I want to talk kind of two stories today about Holden and try to interweave some geology and some other things in this. And I'm going to start off with the players over here. I broke one of the rules of teaching is you don't write things in red or green because nobody can read them, but I can't get the black ones to work. So I'm going to start off with number one, a piece of gneiss. Gneiss is a rock. It's a metamorphic rock found all over the Cascades. This particular piece of gneiss is about 3 to 4 feet long this way, about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. And I know this piece of rock quite intimately, and I'll let you know how I know later on in the story today, but that's one of the major pieces in the story. This piece of gneiss sits off of Cascade Pass over here, about maybe 15 miles north of Holden. Cascade Pass is the headwaters of the Stehekin River, which flows down into Lake Chelan, and the headwaters of the Cascade River on the other side of the range. Cascade Pass is a beautiful hike, not a dangerous hike. Safe. It's like Golden Holden Lake. This piece of gneiss today resides at the bottom of that valley. This piece of gneiss got its start a long time ago. It's part of the complicated makeup of this range. Some ranges like the Tetons in Wyoming are quite simple. There's a fault on one side, a fault on the other, and a bunch of granite in the middle that popped up out of the ground. The Cascades are not that way. It's a collection of sub-ranges. We live here in the Chelan sub-range, starting with kind of copper and buckskin here. The mountains wind down to the lake and then wind down along the lake, and it's a Chelan sub-range, and it's made up of a distinctive kind of rock. Other sub-ranges in the Cascades are made up of totally different types of rock. These rocks did not all come here at the same time. They came here based on number two of the players, plate tectonics. If you're familiar with plate tectonics at all, it's the theory that on top of the molten earth are these various plates that are floating around. Some are sliding next to each other, and if you live in California, you're very familiar with the San Andreas Fault, and when these plates slip a little bit, you get big earthquakes that drop freeways on cars and things like that. In the northwest here, we've got the continental plate where we're sitting right now, and there's a plate under the Pacific that's a heavier plate that's sliding underneath this plate where we're sitting. So this process is slowly taking place. In the course of 200, 300, 400 million years, different sections of rock have slammed into this area of North America, and not all have subducted or gone underneath the plate. Some have stayed there and have formed this range. The main core of the Cascades over here is some stuff called gneiss. They call it Skagit gneiss after the Skagit River Valley up here. And climbers have a joke about gneiss. Gneiss can be nice, and gneiss can be not so nice, too. Gneiss looks like granite. Granite is very solid rock, with the crystals are all kind of jumbled. But in gneiss, they all get lined up real nice. And if it's solid gneiss, and you're a rock climber, it holds together real fine. But some of the gneiss in the Cascades is horribly shattered and cracked, and you pull it out in chunks. You grab on something this size, and it might come out in your hand. So gneiss varies in its quality. the Skagit gneiss and our particular friend up here, this 3 to 4 foot piece of gneiss, they think formed around 220 million years ago. And many of these sections of rock that came in from thousands of miles away. These pieces of rock kind of piled up here, and then something started happening about 90 to 60 million years ago. The next player, the molten earth, gets a little more involved. You're familiar with the volcanoes in the Northwest, but there's been a lot of so-called volcanic action that took place under the earth around here. If molten rock makes it out of the earth, we usually call it extrusive rock. The volcanoes, Rainier, Glacier Peak, Mount Baker, are volcanoes. But a lot of the cooking in the Cascades has to do with the intrusive rock. These are granitic rocks, which it's molten lava that fills spaces underground and cools underground. It never breaks the surface. In this valley, we've got 3 or 4 of these various plutons or batholiths of rock that have come up and cooked the rock around it. So the gneiss and the things that were in place are cooked by these batholiths. This causes a lot of mineralization, and you get things like the Holden Mine up here. At the head of the valley is Cloudy Pass. The largest batholith in the Central Cascades is the Cloudy Pass batholith. It's about 100 square miles of granitic rock. It's not Yosemite quality granite, but there is a fair amount of granite. North Star Mountain at the head of the valley is made out of this particular batholith, and it extends north quite a ways. These batholiths have cooked a lot of the rock, so we have a lot of mining between here and Trinity, which lies not too many miles away in this direction over here. The Holden Mine is not the only mine that has been formed by this various cooking over the years. The Cascades has a rich history of mining. Holden is one of the more calm ones. Has anybody heard of Monte Cristo mm-hmm. on the west side of the range? Mm-hmm. Okay, Monte Cristo is a mining town that grew around the turn of the century, in the 1880s into the 1890s. It's at a much lower elevation than Holden is. It's around 1,000 feet, I think, and it was a much rougher place. The saloons and brothels apparently were quite numerous there. But there was a lot of mining in that district in the early days. It's probably one of the more successful areas in the Cascades next to Holden. The Trinity Mine over at Phelps Creek over here, if you go up to Lyman Lake, it's just the other side, was also another mining district, that was quite, worked extensively. The people got there through a wagon road and walking from Leavenworth. It was a long ways to get up there. If you tromp around above Lyman Lake, you'll run into some old mines with some big equipment. Apparently somebody brought a rather large Ford motor engine up there to work in their mine. And the story goes that I heard this guy broke his leg up there working it, and his wife finally came up there and hauled him out, and I guess that was the end of his mining ventures up there. If you hike up to Lyman Lake, there's a mine that you pass in the side of the rock over there. It's just a shaft that goes in a ways. I've heard stories about that one in World War I that was owned by some Germans. They were taking ore out of there, transporting it over to the lake, down the lake, over to Seattle, where it was put on a boat to Argentina and then carried by U-boat over to Germany. Now, I've never had that corroborated, but it's an interesting story anyway.
What kind?
I don't remember.
I mean, it would have to be really something quite valuable to go through all that.
Yeah, and I've heard the story so long ago, I'm thinking it might have been molybdenum or something, but I'm not sure. Is that what it was? Okay.
Steel.
Which would be, useful in making steel.
And so were they able to actually smelt it to some degree up there? Or?
I have no idea. I've tried to find some more documentation. Have you heard something about this story? Or okay, I've tried to find more documentation, but I've never heard, seen it anywhere in printing. I've just heard it orally. So you got, I mean, there was a polar bear up at Lyman Lake for a while too. So. You have to take these stories with a grain of salt. There was an albino black bear up there apparently, but rumor had it was a polar bear for a while. This was years ago in the mining days. If you go down the road to Monkey Bear Falls, the reason Monkey Bear Falls is on the map now, on an old map, there's a mine up on that ridge at the top of 9 Mile called the Adel Mine. Me and two other guys decided to try to find this mine one day and the old trail that went up there. As we were bashing through the brush over there, we came to the top of this cliff, and as we worked our way around, we saw this rather pretty waterfall. We went up in the spring, and it was running quite heavily at the time. We happened to look down at the base of the waterfall, and on the snowfield at the bottom was one of the hugest black bears I've ever seen in the Holden area. And that had something to do with the name of Monkey Bear Falls. My hiking companion was a guy named Tom Alstrom. If you've ever been to the Harborview Cafe down in Pepin, Minnesota, him and Paul Hinderle own that. Tom really liked the place. And actually, Tom ended up spending 2 weeks down there. He put up a tent, brought some wine over, a box of cigars, and just decided to have a little retreat down there. And Tom used to tell a story of his grandfather in Iowa, that they'd go to visit his grandfather, and his grandfather didn't want the kids running in the cornfield to get lost. So he said, well, at night, you know, the monkey bears come out in the cornfield out there, and they will eat you if you're running around in that cornfield at night. So he's trying to scare the kids to keep them out of the cornfield because it was a big field, and he didn't want them to get lost in that. Hence, we gave the name to that waterfall, Monkey Bear Falls, hoping to scare people to stay away, and now they built a trail down there. So it didn't work. It didn't work. Anyway, back to the geology and the players. I want to run up to number 4 real quick. Erosions, glaciers, and the climate. They're also a player in this over the big picture. The other night when I showed my slides, I mentioned something about glaciers receding in the valleys. I always think that's my imagination, so I went and looked at the guidebook for the North Cascades. And there's a picture in there of Upper Lyman Basin from about the turn of the century, well, probably about the 1920s. And the Lyman Glacier extends halfway down to Lyman Lake. There's an entire glacier, glacial ice from Spider Pass up there, halfway down to Lyman. It's three times the size that it is now. So the glaciers are receding. But glaciers in the North Cascades have come and gone for years, as they have in all of the Northwest. Glaciers change without much climatic change. If you go north of here, up into the Coast Range and up into Alaska, you'll find some of the largest glaciers in the world, and they're really not that far away from here. And it probably is what Holden looked like 13 to 15,000 years ago. We've had some real interesting glaciation around here. The record that I understand is not real clear because so many have come and gone. But the Cascades formed, and then they were cooked, and then they started to erode. And before the glaciers did their work, there was a lot of erosion in the Cascades, a lot of stream work. It was a rugged place. Speaking from experience, this rock is not Yosemite quality. It breaks and it falls down quite easily. As you look up and down the valleys, you see large slopes of talus. Erosion does a nice job here. It's a steep range, partly because the rock is so rotten from a climbing standpoint. The glaciers, however, picked up and really did a number on the range. That lovely lake you came up was probably the largest example of a glacier on this side of the range. They estimate the ice was, if I can see my notes here, let me find this real quick. I don't remember his numbers real well, so I have to write these down. And then I wore my contacts, so I can't see anything. 1 to 2 miles wide, 70 miles long, 2,500 to 3,000 feet thick was the ice in Lake Chelan that they think had a major impact on carving that lake. One of the major feeders was this valley. It was completely glaciated. If you walk down to 10 mile, you can see some big boulders lying around. These are probably from the Cloudy Pass batholith, and were transported down here via these glaciers. They're nice granite rock. Back when I was climbing a lot and I'd come here, I'd go down and boulder on them because the rock was really solid. It's not this nice that you find in the major crest around here. It's nice rock. There's another interesting form of glaciation that took place in the course of all these glaciations, and it kind of fooled some geologists for a while. There was a series of continental glaciations that came down out of Canada on the east and west side of the Cascades. And yet, the Cascades didn't have a lot of glaciation going on. So those glaciers actually worked their way from the valleys up into the mountains. When Puget Sound and that was carved out, these glaciers worked themselves up west side streams. They impounded large lakes on the west side. There were a couple thousand feet of ice where Seattle is right now. And on this side of the mountains, it wasn't as dramatic, except at Lake Chelan. They think one of these tongues of ice came up the lake fairly far. And according to my geology teacher, I did take a class in geology at college. According to my geology teacher, there was a dam built some years ago in the Cascades, and it was built on the assumption that the glaciers had come down out of the mountains instead of the glaciers coming up into the mountains, and they kind of blew it with the rubbly moraine material, and when they started filling up the lake behind the dam, the thing leaked terribly. They couldn't keep the water in the reservoir, and they had to abandon the dam. I've never found out where that was, but he assured me it was true. we've had some smaller glaciations here in the last couple thousand years, about 2,500 years ago. You can find some newer moraines from that time where the glaciers did expand into the valleys a little bit. And also, in the last century and a half or so, the glaciers were doing real well. Not just here, but in other ranges around the country as well. About the mid-19th century, they think that those glaciers reached their maximum, and they've been receding ever since. And global warming or whatever is going on does seem to be taking its toll. Somebody pointed out that in Glacier National Park, they think in the next 20 to 30 years, most of those glaciers will be gone there. And the glaciers in this range are also hurting right now as well. You and I. We tend to think in terms of our lifespan, and I also tend to think in terms that I plan what I do. I'm here today because I worked hard and went to college, and I've climbed mountains and done all this stuff, and we do affect our lives, and there's no doubt about that. But I also do think that there's something else going on out there that I can't explain. I've never been one to say this was meant to happen, and some people do that, and that's fine, and I've never been one to put a lot of faith in miracles. However, when I see some of the little circumstances in my life that have changed my life so dramatically, one begins to wonder. My wife and I have adopted two children. You know, we tried to have children and things didn't work out the way we had planned. And when I look back at that, I have a hard time saying this was not meant to be. Something took place here. But in reality, it boils down to the mole on my son's cheek. My son has a large mole on his face. And if you've ever adopted children, it's basically you're getting a license to have kids. They do not go easy on you. It's a very difficult process. They put my wife and I through the ringer to be sure we would be fit parents. It's called the home study. It takes 2 or 3 months to do. And they examine every bit of your childhood and family life to see if you have any problems with child rearing. And it's a very exhausting thing to do. We finished the child study, and the social worker was happy with us, and she said, well, the next step is to finish the paperwork and get you a referral for a child. So about 5 days after she finished, she called, and I'm sitting down, and I answer the phone, and hello, you know, it's a social worker. Oh, how can I help you? I figured she needed some information for the paperwork, and she said, well, are you sitting down? I said, yeah, and well, I have a referral for you. And this was 5 days earlier. She said it'd be 10 to 12 months until we got a referral. Well, as part of the paperwork, you have to go through a checklist of all the conditions that you will accept in a child. And it's a scary thing because you project all these awful things. You know, one of them was literally, will you take a child with more than 5 fingers? Because every so often a child will have a deformity on their hand, and it's very fixable by surgery. Will you take a child with brain injury? Will you take a child with an alcoholic mother? And you're scared to death after going through this form. And one of the things that we had to check was, will you accept a child with a visible birthmark? And we said, sure. Okay. And yet, even when I checked that, I had this vision of a lot of disfigurement. Well, my son has a visible birthmark. And we apparently are about the only family that checked yes to that. My son's paperwork jumped to the top of the pile, and it was our names, and that's why we got the boy that we have today. It was because of that birthmark. So planning is an interesting thing. Now, to go back to this a little bit, I need to talk about my wife and I a little bit here, because we enter into this story, because 220 million years is going to meet shortly with my lifespan in this story. My wife and I met up here in 1979 over in a snack bar over here. We spent about 2 weeks together, and she left the village. She was up here working in the snack bar for 4 weeks. Came back about 2 months later after we corresponded, and she spent another 10 days in the village. Had to go home to Minnesota for a couple of weeks, came back, and I asked her maybe if she wanted to get married after being together for about 4 weeks. She said she'd think about it, and a year later we were married in the gym over here. We spent a couple winters up here, and after that we moved over to Olympia, Washington. We like to hike. We spend a lot of time together in the mountains. And in 1981, we found ourselves walking up the trail towards Cascade Pass. Meanwhile, above us on the trail was my friendly piece of Skagit gneiss sitting in the side of a cliff. Where it has sat for about 220 million years. It had been cooked by a couple of batholiths up there and changed, no doubt. It had been eroded with rocks being stripped away from the surface. It had been glaciated, no doubt. It probably was quite deeply down inside some cliff somewhere up there. And this rack and I really have no reason to think that we should ever get to know each other. Well, as we were walking up towards the pass, there was a snowfield, and it had to be at most 20 degrees. It was fairly low angle. And I started to walk across the snowfield, and we heard a clunk. Well, this rock somewhere far above us decided it was time to leave his perch and head down to the valley below. My wife stopped before she got on the snow, and I stopped on the snow, and I'm looking up. And it wasn't a huge noise, but as I looked up, I saw, for the first time in its 220 million years of existence, this piece of rock rapidly rolling down the mountain. It was like a frisbee on end, spinning. It was only 6 to 8 inches wide, but being the 3 to 4 foot rock that it was, it was moving quite quickly and made me very nervous. Terry said, "Get out of the way!" And I didn't know what to do, so I'm doing this thing, you know, this big and it looks like it's going to go between me and my wife. So I figure I'm okay here. Well, as we all know about frisbees, any shift in angle causes a shift in trajectory. And suddenly it leaned a little bit, and it's arcing right towards me. And I'm beginning to think, I got to get out of the way here. But I don't know if I was panicked or what. I just didn't know where to go. And finally, the last minute, I realized it's like a freight train coming at me. I literally dove out of the way. It went by me and disappeared down into the valley below. It's probably the closest I've ever come to getting hurt badly or killed in the mountains. And it was on a trail coming up to Cascade Pass. Why, in its 220 million year existence, it broke loose at that moment, I do not know. But it did, and I became very close to geology at the time with that rock. I'm still here today, and I'm thankful for that. But we often think, like I've said, in the terms of our lives, and I just wanted to expand your thinking a little more. These mountains have been here a long time, and their makeup is quite involved. There is a book in the library in the bookstore that goes into the geology quite heavily. I'm not going to do that today, but you're welcome to take a look at that. Just a little bit more about the range. Most of the rock in the range is metamorphic. It is rock that has been changed and altered by pressure and by heat, usually. Like I said, the batholiths are igneous, as are the volcanoes. And the volcanoes have had a great impact on the range as well, especially Mount Rainier. If you don't live in the Northwest, and even if you do live in the Northwest, you probably don't realize the impact that these structures have on the Northwest. If you were here in 1980, you do. My wife and I were at Holden Village in May 18th, I believe it was, in 1980. I was going out of the village that day. I was up by my chalet. I lived in Chalet 3, and we heard a popping noise in the village. And every so often, you hear airplanes or sonic barriers broken, and the thought nothing of it. We heard little rumors that St. Helens had erupted and maybe a few people were missing or killed, but you don't get information up here very quickly. But I got on the boat that day, and as we were going down the lake, we went around a corner and we could see down lake suddenly. And at that point, the airplane that flies the lake, he was rushing past us trying to get back to Chelan as well. We couldn't see the end of the lake. And the whole boat got silent. I've never seen anything like that on the lady. Everyone stopped and were staring because there was this black wall at the lake. It was the ash from Mount St. Helens. We got into the ash, got to the boat dock, and it was actually 25 Mile Creek then, and started driving towards Wenatchee. Well, most of the people on the boat were heading towards Spokane. They couldn't get out of Wenatchee. The only roads open in and out of Wenatchee were coming up north to Chelan and Highway 2 to Seattle. As we were going above the lake a little bit, there's a place where you can look back and see the lake, and it's not very far below you. We were all in the ash by this time. We got to Wenatchee, saw a couple of cars blowing blue smoke, but they didn't have good air filters on, and the ash was very abrasive, and it ruined their engines, basically. We went up to Leavenworth, a lovely spot. They sell themselves as this beautiful mountain community, and you had to have a mask on. You couldn't breathe the air because of the ash in the air, and they also had Giardia in their water system at the time, so you couldn't drink the water there either, which was kind of an interesting thing. We made it into Seattle okay, and turned on the TV, and the footage is just incredible. The side of the mountain had blown out. I think it took about 50 or 60 lives. I don't recall exactly. And totally altered the landscape down at St. Helens. If you get a chance and you're in that area, go out to the park. It's just an incredible place now. And you've seen, you know, you can see there what can happen. The big fear out here is Mount Rainier. If Mount Rainier would get active, there are thousands of people that would be affected by that. And it's not necessarily the fact that it might explode. About 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, there was something called the Osceola Mud Flow that came off of Mount Rainier and traveled a long ways down the mountain. You got a lot of water sitting up there to 14,000 feet. You've got some of the largest glaciers in the lower 48 states on that mountain. They had a major mud flow that, if it happened today, I thought I heard the number 75,000 people live in the area of the Osceola Mud Flow. Now, you know, it's a huge amount of people that could be affected by that. Luckily for us, volcanoes take many thousands of years sometimes to erupt, but it could possibly happen in the Northwest. And because of those volcanoes, this is also an earthquake region as well, and a lot of people don't realize that. So there is some excitement about living in Washington that we don't get in Minnesota, you know. Of course, we get tornadoes too. Pardon? Oh. But I just wanted to throw that in there a little bit about the igneous rock, because it is a concern around here. The volcanoes are just spectacular. It's in friends on Mount Adams when St. Helens blew, and they got ashed quite heavily. It's very close to St. Helens. And there's some pictures in National Geographic of that. This woman was standing there, and she literally fell down in shock, you know, this huge explosion and then the mushroom cloud going up. I've hiked east of Glacier Peak. Glacier Peak has had major eruptions. There's some highlands over there loaded with pumice from the mountain that's still there from its eruption. I think it was 10 or 12,000 years ago. Mount Garibaldi up in Canada actually erupted in an ice cap, and there was a lot of ice that was affected as the lava poured out on top of it, and Garibaldi has kind of fallen apart because this made the base of the volcano very unstable. So it's real interesting geology over here. One last thing I do want to address is the climate, and this kind of has to do with what we're doing here at Holden. The climate is a major player out here. This time of year it's fire, but if you live on the west side of the mountains and are Seattleite, you know about the jungles over there. Before forestry was done, those are basically jungles, were very, very difficult to travel through. Monte Cristo Mine, when it opened up in the 1880s, they built a railroad between Monte Cristo and the coast so they could bring the ore out to the coast. And one of the reasons Monte Cristo failed was they had a hard time keeping the railroad tracks in place. There's an interesting phenomenon in the Cascades, and I've seen it over and over again. We'll get a lot of snow in like November, October, November, the higher elevations. And then some big honking storm rolls in from the coast with a lot of warm air with it. It's weird out here. In Minnesota, it snows and it gets cold. In Washington, it snows and it warms up. we'll get these heavy snowfalls that come in on a warm air mass with the cold air mass in place, and you get these beautiful, beautiful snows coming down. And then it warms up, and it warms up, and the snow turns to rain, and freezing levels go up. And you might get a very heavy rainfall with freezing levels at 13, 14,000 feet in November and December. One year at Christmas, it was 60-some in Seattle, and Mount Rainier wasn't even white. I mean, it looked brown because the snow levels had raised up to 14,000 feet, and there are some heavy rains, and you get huge amounts of flooding, especially on the west side. And these floods continue to take out this poor railroad at Monte Cristo and made it very difficult to make a profit over there. And the Monte Cristo town is kind of folded up. You can still visit Monte Cristo. You used to be able to drive within a mile or two of it, but now it's a long ways in now, I think. They closed the road. Pardon?
You can mountain bike in.
Oh, that would be fun. Have you been in there?
Yeah.
A lot of the buildings are still there. And I've hiked around in the basins up above, and you can see a lot of the old shafts, and they had a tramway that they built between the mine and the towns, and it's kind of an interesting place over there. This side, it's easier because the mountains are more open. The climate is much more friendly, although the 325 inches of snow you get here every year is a bit of an impediment to the work that they do here. But that's nothing compared to the 600 to 800 inches you might get on the west side of the mountains. Paradise up at Mount Rainier has had over 1,000 inches in one season. Mount Baker had over 1,000 inches 2 years ago, the Mount Baker ski area. I think I said this the other day, it's the only ski area that I know of that gets closed because they have too much snow and they can't keep the lifts running. And this brings along avalanche danger with it makes the mountains somewhat dangerous in the winter. I'm going to talk more about avalanches on Friday when I take people for a walk around here. That's kind of a hint at the dangers that I'm referring to. But that is a real concern with people living in the valley. That brings us to you and I. We are all here today because these geologic factors came into play, because of plate tectonics, because we've had human interaction. When Holden came up the valley in the early 1900s and saw the red outcrop up at Honeymoon Heights, he started something that allowed us to be here today, mining in the valley. He apparently had a cabin up at Holden Lake and had prospected in the area quite a bit. Howe Sound had the pockets to develop the ore body and do the mining starting in the 1930s. The price of copper went up. They stopped mining in 58 or 57. I always forget. I'm a history teacher, and I tell my kids, I don't remember dates. You don't have to either. I tell them, I got to know 1492 maybe, and maybe 1776. And they should know that the Civil War was like in the middle of the 18th century. But I'm not really good with dates. I think my daughter's birthday is Friday. But now we are here. It's a Lutheran retreat center. I'm not going to probe any personal beliefs today. You can believe that you're here for whatever reason you choose to believe. And if that has a religious significance as well, I guess I am a strong believer in faith and think that has something to do with things. But these little coincidences add up to us being here today, to me getting to know you, and to you getting to know each other. And I guess my thing that I want to do here is encourage people to enjoy the outdoors, understand the land, look up whenever you get a chance. I try to do that as much as possible here. One thing that's changed in the 20 years that I've been here is the clarity of the air. I still come out in the morning and I look up at Buckskin and it's clear. When I was here 20 years ago, the tailings were blowing up to 8,000 to 9,000 feet in elevation, and it was always this dust pile up over this way. Buckskin was never very clear. So that's changed over the years. The tailings are now brown. They used to be bright orange. I had the dubious distinction of being on garbage detail 20-some years ago before we have what we have in place now, and we'd bury a lot of the garbage up in the tailings. And the tailings were orange because they oxidize on the surface, but they're really cool when you start digging in there with a backhoe. We'd dig pits about 10, 12 feet deep, and we'd be pulling up greens and purples and blues, very, very colorful stuff. I was always concerned we were going to hit barrels. My understanding is there's barrels of chemicals buried in the tailings. We never did, but it was very colorful stuff we were digging into. I still wonder about what I've inhaled to this day out there working. But basically, that's my presentation here. I wanted to just leave some time for people with any questions about anything. I am going to do some slideshows later in the week. I'm repeating the one I did the other day tonight, I guess at 8:30. I'm doing one on Greenland, which has absolutely nothing to do with Holden, on Friday night. But I love Greenland. It's an amazing place, and most people are not very familiar with it. And if you're as hot as I've been lately, it's kind of nice to think about cold places right now. but any questions or comments about anything in the area or anything related with the mountains at all? Yes, sir.
When we went up to the mine yesterday, the presentation, you could look up back here, I think it's Copper.
The big one up the head of the valley?
Yeah.
That's Bonanza.
Bonanza, okay.
Yeah.
You can't see the big glacier on the right from here. Well, once you get around the corner a little bit, you can see that. Is that just is that a crevasse down the middle of that, or is it falling apart? It looks like it's a big crack right down the middle of it anyway.
Yes, to both. Yeah. Yeah. It's heavily crevassed. It's also fallen apart somewhat over the last 20 years. The Mare Green is on a fairly flat area up high, and then it's on a steeper slope down low. And with its movement, you get a lot of breakage in the glacier. When you climb it, you can't go up the center of it because of the crevasses. You have to go around on the right-hand side. But also at the snout, where it used to be glacier, it's a lot of rock slabs right now. And it's real treacherous down there because you'll have perched boulders that were left there by the glacier that, you know, you can just touch like that and they're gone. And if you're with a party of three or four people and somebody's not thinking, it's real easy to dump rocks on each other. So it is a real jumbled mess.
It looks pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
But you can't see it from here until you get around the corner.
And what's really spectacular, there's one about three times the size on the back of Bonanza that's really difficult to see from everywhere called the Company Glacier. There's also the Isella Glacier, which if you go to Heart Lake, you're under the Isella Glacier. You can't see it from Heart Lake, but if you look up towards Bonanza and you get up there, there's a huge meadow up above you right when you get to the lake and past it. The Isella Glacier is directly above you at that point, and it's at about 8,000 feet. And I went up there once, which was one of the crazier things I've ever done, but there are no flat spots up there. That's one of the larger avalanche paths in the area, and I've seen debris that has come down there into Heart Lake and gone up the other side of the valley a bit. And in the summer, it's a very safe place to be, but in the winter, that's one of the better avalanche paths around right there. Yes, sir?
The actual mine, the copper, you can almost go vertically, the vein of copper, at least in the picture that they're showing it, which gives the idea that one time it may have been horizontal and got pushed up. Or can you talk about that in this other at all, or how that particular vein got formed?
I don't know the specifics. I believe it got formed through this intrusive process. As the minerals would, as the heat would come up from the batholith, the mineralization would occur along large and long cracks. And my understanding is the veins of copper around here, these flies are terrible, the veins of copper are rather long and straight because the rock that they were intruding was fairly cracked. That's about all I know. I do know that they follow the vein from what they called copper into Irene Peak, which we now call Buckskin. And I think it's also related with the stuff over in Trinity. I know another story, and this one I never heard corroborated either, and I probably shouldn't tell this one. But rumor, probably good anyway. Rumor had it that once upon a time the military was looking at using the inside of Copper Mountain for some sort of base, and they could connect from tunnels from the Trinity mine over at Phelps Creek because the ore body is kind of connected, and there was a lot of tunneling over there. I heard that from a former business manager. I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, there's another guy named Rick who's coming up, I believe, today or tomorrow, Rick Dunning, who is a geologist, and he works with the Mine Museum, and I'd ask him that one.
Okay.
Because that's beyond my amateurish knowledge of geology. But I hope you all get out and hike and do some things and see some things. The bugs are awful and the heat's terrible. Go early and slap a lot, I guess. Any other questions? Okay, it's a little early. It's only about 11:30, but that's basically what I've got for now. I appreciate you all coming, and enjoy the village.